Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast is titled Political Correctness, American Style. Recorded in 1995, Dr. James M. Buchanan, 1986 Nobel Prize winner in economics and professor at George Mason University, and Dr. Alan Mandelstam, professor emeritus, Virginia Tech, discuss developments on college campuses in America. We hope you enjoyed today's podcast, and don't forget to subscribe to the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
Well, I thought when this general discussion, what we should do first, Al, would be to have you tell us a little bit about your experience as instructing undergraduates in principles of economics. I know that we have talked about this, and I think everybody recognizes that you have probably taught more undergraduate economic students than anyone else in the world, maybe more undergraduate students than anyone else in the world. And I know also that you were the innovator in using the closed circuit TV technology. I know you did that both at Michigan State and at Virginia Tech. And I thought maybe we'd just start off by a little bit of your elaborating on your experiences.
Yes, I did teach at Michigan State and at Virginia Tech. I started out teaching the large lectures, a regular large lecture in principles of economics. And then they became so many students that it was decided it would be wise to do television. So I did do television in a large auditorium in front of a large group of students. This was first at Michigan State. And then we sent that to various rooms where students could be, and we replayed it on tape later on in the day so that we could have many hours of classrooms, different hours of classrooms. And that way, I could handle 1,000, 1,200 students regularly. As a matter of fact, I could have handled even more, but I asked them always, that is, I asked the university always, to provide an alternative in case someone didn't like me, they could have some other way of taking economics. And I did that at Michigan State for 11 years. And then I came to Virginia Tech. Of course, before then, I'd been doing smaller classes at Northwestern and Vanderbilt. When I came to Virginia Tech, I did essentially the same thing, so that by the time I ended my career, I had taught about 100,000 students, more or less, officially enrolled, and many others who listened in without being officially enrolled. At the end, I was broadcasting on cable, local cable systems, so that I don't know how many thousands of people saw me. A large number of people saw me, at any rate.
Well, it seemed to me the great advantage of your scheme, as opposed to sort of using TV tapes, was that it was still current, basically still very current. It was day to day. It wasn't putting something on tape and picking it up, and that has a big advantage.
Yeah, that's right. You see, I didn't simply use last year's tapes over again. Each year, I made new tapes. I taught a new class. Obviously, much of the material was the same. I mean, a demand and a supply curve is a demand and a supply curve. But I always applied them to the recent developments. And of course, one could emphasize what was current at the moment. And of course, over the years, obviously, the economics itself changes, and certain, especially in macro, the emphasis changed a great deal. So we also, therefore, were able to answer questions from the floor. And we got an idea of what sort of questions students would ask, how they would ask them. Of course, then I incorporated some of the questions in my lecture already, because I knew after a little while the sorts of questions students would ask. But students did have the opportunity to ask questions there.
Well, I can see this was really a big advantage over tapes. But on the other hand, don't you agree with me that even today, we don't use tapes enough of earlier stuff, especially of other people. Seems to me that we're wasting a lot of talent of people who could be putting some lectures on tape, which would be relevant to a lot
yes.
of things, and bring that in. I
agree with that. I think that that would be a very good thing. And of course, universities in general are loath to use tapes from outsiders. They somehow feel that that reflects on them adversely. I don't know why. After all, each university is not going to have a whole pantheon of Nobel Prize people and outstanding economists. Why not use these people? or good teachers, why not use their talents in addition to the people who are hired by the particular university?
It seemed to me that this is an area where we really need some entrepreneurship, some innovation.
Well, I suggested many years ago, as a matter of fact, I suggested to a publisher that we do my tapes. But at the time, of course, this was many years ago when VCRs were very uncommon. At the time, the publisher said, look, we're publishing books. We've always published books. We're not interested in tapes. And so it was not done at that time.
Well, I know during this experience, at least as a colleague at Virginia Tech, I know that you had the repute of being a very popular teacher, an extremely popular teacher, but on the other hand, were a tough teacher. You were a hard grader, and you kept them up to standard despite the fact that they all enjoyed taking the class.
Well, this was always my philosophy. I felt that it was important to increase interest, and I did use certain entertainment elements to increase the interest. I thought that was just the way teaching should be carried out. On the other hand, I at no time sacrificed content for entertainment. People who did not see me and heard about the entertainment aspect frequently thought that I was a pure entertainer, but the students never thought that, because I gave them as much material as I possibly could, and I demanded of them that they know it.
Well, that gives me a good lead-in to our second general topic, and that is this entertainment aspect. That's what ultimately got you into trouble.
Indeed,
and
it
I
did.
I would be interested in your elaborating a little bit on your experiences at Virginia Tech in that connection.
Well, it happened in my 11th year at Virginia Tech. So by that time, I had already taught maybe 35 or 40,000 students at Tech, aside from what I had taught earlier at Michigan State and Vanderbilt and Northwestern and so forth. And one day, the equal opportunities officer came in and accused me of, quote, sexual harassment. Well, what is it that I'd done? I mean, sexual harassment, one connotes rape or attempted rape, chasing co-eds. What horrible thing had I done? Behind locked doors had I done it? No. Something I'd done in class, on TV tape, in front of thousands and thousands of people. And apparently, there had been one complaint, although at the time I was not told that it was one complaint. I was told that there were complaints. But the president of the university later told me there had been one complaint from one, presumably a co-ed, who said that I said something which was sexist. And therefore, this constituted sexual harassment. I was taken aback. I said, well, I can't. I knew the reaction of my students. It seemed impossible that I would have sexual harassment charges. And sexual harassment connotes such a thing. It connotes this business of rape. And this was not the case at all. Well, would you believe the EOAA person took this to the dean and told the dean that no woman dared ask a question in my class for fear of being humiliated by the very fact that she was a woman. The dean believed this equal opportunities person and suggested to the chairman of my department, without speaking to me, without watching the tapes, all of this is on tape, without further ado, he suggested that I be dismissed from the classroom. That's a startling thing. You know, people, when they hear the word sexual harassment today, go absolutely wild. Well, lo and behold, the chairman of the department convinced the dean that I should not be dismissed from class, but I made a survey of my students, or I had my assistants make a survey in order to defend myself. I sent the results of the survey to the Equal Opportunities Office without knowing the tally myself, but quite sure that the tally would favor me, and I got back a note from the Equal Opportunities Office. Thank you for this information sharing opportunity. Yep. We are returning the note to you unopened because it is not germane to the issue at hand. The next day, I got a formal letter of reprimand with the approval, it turned out, of the vice provost, who also did not speak to me, saying that they were letting me off the hook for this time, but they were going to watch every word I was going to say in class, and woe be it to me if I should repeat these terrible sexual harassment deeds. Well, I I flew up to the ceiling on this. And I approached the provost with the results of my survey. Now, the survey showed that out of 499 students, three felt that I had made sexist remarks. The 496 thought that I had not. Now, that by itself would seem to tell you something. I demanded an apology of the provost. The provost did send me an apology after considerable delay and hinged with all sorts of political this and that. But the president of the university told me that I should have admitted guilt whether I was guilty or not, and that I should apologize. It doesn't matter whether I did the right thing or the wrong thing, I should apologize. I took that, frankly, as quite an insult. That year, well, I did ask for an outright apology, a clear-cut apology, and the university refused to send this out. And the president then issued a statement which was taken by many to be a countermanding of the provost's apology, although in fact it was not. It merely reinforced the idea of equal opportunities. But everyone thought it to be that. If you didn't read it, you got that idea. That year, I got a below average wage increase. Now, my wage was high, and I didn't need the money, but I could not help but, under the circumstances, think that this might be some sort of a reprisal, a punitive action. I approached the chairman of the department. He said nothing. That obviously increased my feelings. The next year, I got another below average increase. The third year, the chairman asked me if I would be the acting chairman of the department while he was away in San Diego. I was at Virginia. I thought, well, this at least seems to express confidence in me. So I agreed somewhat reluctantly because I'd wanted to take a leave myself. When the time came for me to become chairman, the chairman told me that I was not then going to become chairman. It had been announced, but that he was going to stay for a period of time, an unannounced period of time. I thought this very, very strange. Well, I waited, so to speak, outside his door for 3 weeks. And finally, I went in and I said, Dan, the chairman, I simply have to know, am I going to be chairman or am I not going to be chairman? And he said, yes, you're going to be chairman in a week. But he then proceeded to tell me that when he leaves in a week, he is going to retain all the powers of the chair from San Diego. He will handle it by phone, by fax, and he will be flying frequently from San Diego back to Virginia to take over. Well, I said, this is impossible. Why? I mean, I never anticipated that I would have no powers of the chair if I'm acting chairman. After I finished protesting, I said, well, why don't we discuss it with the dean? I went to the dean. The dean said, you're right, but I can't help it. And the chairman, ultimately, after I protested to him and asked him to change his mind, to some extent at least, called me up one night and said he had named an associate professor as chairman, as acting chairman. He was putting me on leave at half pay. Since it was in the term was already underway, it was too late for me to get another opportunity in another university, and so I lost half my pay. Yeah. I thought this was an extraordinary statement of non-confidence in me for no reason at all. That year, I again got a below average increase. I again asked the dean, no result. The following year, again, an equal opportunities problem. The equal opportunities office wanted me to give a passing grade to an equal opportunity student who was the lowest grade in my, second lowest grade in my class of 1,200. When I refused, the student was taken out of my class. It was supposed to be unbeknown to me, but I found out later on. The chairman took the student into a private study course, gave the student the passing grade, and that grade was substituted for my course in the student's requirements. And I, when I protested, got a severe tongue lashing from the chairman of the department. Well, I pass over several other reprimands of similar nature. The chairman now leaves. I get a fourth below average increase, and the chairman now leaves. A new chairman takes over. And lo and behold, I get another reprimand pertaining to equal opportunities. It seems that there is another complaint about one particular statement that I had made in class. And I asked the chairman what the statement was, and he told me. And I said, well, that statement was made 9 months earlier in class. He said, yes, Well, I said, why am I just hearing about it now? He said, well, the students just came to me now complaining 9 months later. I said, how many on the evaluation form? How many students complained? He said, none. I said, well, if you want to see it, it's on tape. You can see the remark. He said, I don't want to see it. He proceeded to reprimand me without ado, and he then insisted, after I taught all these thousands of students, he then proceeded to insist that I have a male survey made every term from then on to test me for sexism. I had had enough. I had told the university that if something were not done to reassure me, I would resign. The university refused to reassure me and, in fact, continued to pour the reprimands on. And so finally, one day in class, I walked into class and resigned on the spot. So,
I know this case became a cause célèbre. I know there were several national magazine articles written about the Mandelstam case. I know Walter Williams had a column. I know other people had columns. And so it became one of the rather extreme examples of how this political correctness, sexist, sexual harassment notion is really having a major impact on university teaching. It must have been very inhibiting, even though I can. It was interesting to have you detail all the history of it. It even while that was going on, you must have been looking over your shoulder every time you spoke a word.
Well,
that's the damaging part.
Exactly. That's the damaging. You know, a short time after I resigned, a mathematics professor at Tech came to me and said, thank God I've got no blacks in my class this term. And I said, I knew him not to be an anti-black of any sort. And mathematics, you know, is not very subject to this sort of thing. He said, oh, yes, he said, I might have said something that could be interpreted somehow or other.
Yeah.
And this way, without any blacks in the group, I don't have that danger, I don't think. So it is a very inhibiting factor. In chemistry, as a matter of fact, at Virginia Tech, a professor referred to black-bottomed radiation. I don't know what this is, but apparently it's a term that chemists have used for many years. Whereupon there was an official complaint of racism against him for using the term black-bottomed radiation. Well, at Hollins College, just a short distance from Virginia Tech in Roanoke, a women's college, I know a professor who was officially reprimanded for sexism because he gave a wrong look to a student. The student said that she didn't like the look he gave. Of course, we have all of these cases. Now, there usually are severe penalties for so-called sexism. We have the case, as you know, in New Hampshire, University of New Hampshire, where the communications professor was talking about a simile, and he said a belly dancer is like a bowl of jelly with a vibrator under it. That was considered sexism. Yes, that was sexism. Now, what is the penalty for these things? The professor was asked to leave the classroom for a period of time. He was asked to pay $2,000 for his replacement while this was going on. He would lose his pay during this period of time. He would have to formally apologize to the entire university and take sensitivity classes. He has refused and has now filed suit. Mine happened earlier. If it had happened a little later, I would have filed suit, except you see there was no formal penalty in my case. And this is what made difficult for me. There are many other such cases we could recite, that the University of Chicago or the Chicago Seminary, where the professor was trying to show the difference between the Old Testament and the New, and he had the story about the man who falls down from the second floor and accidentally has intercourse with a woman, and it then is not his fault because it was an accident according to the Old Testament, but the New Testament, I gather, would call it his fault. This was the idea.
And this is something that had been taught for years.
Oh, it had been taught for years and years. Well, the remarks that I was accused of making were remarks that I had made several times. You know, I mean, somebody might wonder what remarks I did make. All right, one remark This is the worst remark, I guess, that I made, worst remark. I noted that in the paper there was a story that said that one woman out of every six graduate students in psychology said that they had had sex with their professor. Now, that is a startling statistic. As a matter of fact, I'd consider that an alarming statistic. But at any rate, I brandished the headline there to the class and said, "Now look," I said, "this is before 1,200 people, and on television," I said, "look, one out of six, I'm not getting my quota. There's something wrong here." Well, that was one of the terrible sexist remarks I had made.
That's the one I heard.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
The one that went around.
Yeah, that's the one. Well, I said it. I'm guilty of it. I said it. At any rate, one cannot say anything of that sort. In the Chicago case, again, the same penalties, suspension, apology to the university demanded, and sensitivity classes, humiliation, in other words. A student at Virginia Tech referring to me said that all professors of that type, of my type, should be required to take the sensitivity classes, and if they don't come around after two times in the sensitivity classes, they should simply be fired.
Well, do you think this has reached its peak and turned around a little? Whether it seems to me, I'm not as close to it as you are, don't keep up with it, but it does seem to me that there became such absurd cases that maybe there's a little bit of a reaction against that taking.
Well, there is a reaction because, of course, we're getting suits now. And as a matter of fact, in a couple cases, well, in the famous California Riverside case, the authorities, the university authorities, have been sentenced to sensitivity sessions about free speech.
Well, I did read about that. Yeah.
Yes, well, that was the case with the T-shirt. This was a T-shirt case with Fraternity House, where they had a Mexican party, and they showed a Mexican with a serape and the high sombrero with a beer in his hand, and that was supposed to be anti-Hispanic.
Oh,
and the fraternity was given the death sentence. That is, they could not enroll new students for 3 years. And the fraternity appealed that, and there was a lawsuit, finally, and the fraternity won, and the university authorities had to take sensitivity sessions on free speech. So we are getting some sort of a, but you see, the pressure is still fought by university officials. They go the way the pressure is.
Right.
And the pressure is still on them because they feel that if the federal government decides that there's been sexism allowed here, it could mean loss of funds, millions and maybe tens of millions of dollars lost, or so they envisage, and they're very sensitive to that. And then there's this guilt feeling that we hurt people in the past, therefore we must bend over backwards not to hurt them, and if we hurt somebody else in the process, it doesn't make any difference. Well, I think it is, I'm hoping that the peak has been reached, but my feeling is still at this moment that we're still subject to this. And of course, it's a terrible inhibiting factor that the general public does not understand and does not realize is happening on campus. Professors simply do not want to speak freely. And what could be worse on a campus than the abridgment of free speech on a campus?
Yeah, it takes away the whole role of a university.
Oh, the role of the university is, of course, to have free speech and to spread knowledge and to have opinions spread. So that I don't object to Hitlerian opinions being stated. Lord knows, I was born Jewish. I am not pro-Hitler. But if people have Hitlerian feelings, I just assume that they express them. I think we can defeat those feelings in the light of free speech. And so, Mohammed, what is his name? I've forgotten the name.
Farrakhan's
man. I object strenuously to what he says, but if he wants to say it, I think he should be allowed to say it. And if somebody wants to express opinions that are anti-black, they should be allowed to express those opinions. I don't agree with them, of course. And I think they will be defeated in the light of free speech.
Well, let's shift a little bit more in a few minutes we have. These are problems besetting universities now. They've been ongoing on almost 10 years, perhaps. And
I'd like for you to speculate, if you would, just a little on how you see the future way universities are likely to develop. Maybe they'll get over this hurdle, maybe mm-hmm. they won't. I read something the other day that public attitudes toward academia and toward universities are now lower than it's been in years. They don't command much respect, or we don't, I should mm-hmm. say, command much mm-hmm. respect in the eyes of the general public.
Yeah.
And, of course, funding has been going down, and publicly and privately. Just how would you speculate about, you know, projections the next couple of decades in this respect?
Well, I think the universities, of course, can recover. I would say this: if they do not change their ways with respect to the matter we just spoke about, it will ultimately, in my view, spell the death knell of universities as we know it. I do not predict that that will happen. I just say if this did not change, it would mean no free speech in universities, and if there's no free speech in universities, we don't have universities in the same light that we have known them, you and I, during our careers. Now, I agree with you. I think that sooner or later, if not now, then shortly, this thing will be stopped, and that particular threat will probably go away. I certainly hope that programs like this and many others and suits and so forth will cause it to go away. There is another problem, of course, with universities, and that is what I call the high schoolization of universities, which is a major problem because, well, look, the latest from Stanford, now one of our very finest institutions, is that the average grade, undergraduate grade at Stanford, is A-. Now, since the highest offsetting grade is A, it means that if the average is A-, very few, if any, people receive anything below a B+. That means that everybody passes automatically. Well, that's what we've been having in our schools for years. Now, presumably, people pass because they have earned passing grades. They pass and they get high grades because they have done well and that they understand the material and the material has been given to them. But today, if everybody gets high grades, then there's no feeling that we have to learn anything. There's no feeling on the part of the faculty that we have to teach anything. And we can just sit there and either mumble in our beards or have a good time without any knowledge passing hands at all. I fear that that is a very major threat to universities because there is the feeling that students must pass.
Well, also, I read recently that they're going to change the SAT score.
Indeed.
In such a way that everybody will be average.
Yes.
Or at least nobody will be below average.
Well, I don't know about that. They're normalizing it at 500 each test. And so what it will mean is that everybody will get a higher score with the same score. That is, with the same result, everybody will get a higher score than they got before, and it will seem as though they've done better, even though they haven't done better. Of course, this is another matter. The SAT scores have been going down and down and down and down over the years. If you look, it's just a straight down. There was a little bit of an upward swing in sort of the late 80s, and then it's gone down again, so that it's now about as low as it's ever been. And why is that? Clearly, we have not been teaching our students. And we've not been teaching our students because we've not been demanding anything of them. We've been giving them these A's. And you know, of course, the advent of the student evaluation of teachers has come to mean a little bit of a feeling that if I give you a high grade, you'll give me a high grade in this teacher evaluation. That's part of it. I think it began with the Vietnam War, where it was felt, gee, if I give this student, a male student, a low grade, he might be sent off to be killed in Vietnam for a war that I, the teacher, don't think is worthy. So I'll give him a high grade anyway. That's how it started. But now we've got no demands on students whatsoever, or it seems to me very little. We don't test them. That's why my test seems so difficult to many students.
Well, I think a lot of it is due to the syndromes of the 60s just carrying over and people in positions of power. I think that's true. But on the other hand, I think that there's another aspect. There's a technological aspect here, and it's the other side of the television. You took advantage of television technology, but there's a negative side, namely the availability of television really increases the opportunity cost of students to learn. If I'd had available when I was growing up, high school, university, if I had had available modern
television with all its options, I doubt if I would have learned as much. I would have learned a different mix, at least.
Oh, yes, it would have been a different mix.
The cost of learning created by television is there's some positive things, but on this, there's some very negative things, too. It's easy to be attracted to the tube and not read your books.
Yes.
I think we've taken that into account.
Well, and now there are all sorts of computer games, which, of course, now the computer can be itself a source of learning. But on the other hand, if one just uses these mindless games with computers and nothing else, it can be an attraction to learning, away from learning. There's no doubt about that. We haven't yet learned the way to use computers in a way that will encourage learning across the board. There are certain little areas where computers have encouraged learning, I believe, even now. But I think we haven't learned the way yet to teach with computers in such a way that it can be fascinating to students and cause students to learn. I think maybe we're having more success with that on the second and third grade level, where they're just beginning to learn computers and so forth, than we are on the more advanced levels, where we're still very awkward with computers when it comes to learning.
It seems to me that we're likely right now, makes it difficult to make projections, because we're likely right now in a situation where there are going to be major innovations, not only technologically, but institutionally. Maybe something other than universities are going to develop here, in which you really get your education going.
Well, you see now, speaking of the computer, of course, in the information highway, we can have one library. That's our computer. We won't need the big university libraries any longer. There will come a day, I believe, when universities will not have their libraries or will not need to have their libraries. And it will be possible to sit at home and learn. The only problem is, how does one vouch that the learning has been accomplished? I suppose we can have exams. We can have lawyers' exams and doctors' exams and accountants' exams. I don't know if we can have exams on fine arts. So easily, that some examining board pass it. But it would be, I think, ultimately, it might be that universities cease to exist as we now know it. I'm talking 50, 60, 70 years from now, and we're all in our homes with our computers getting our degrees through some sort of organized accounting group that stamps its approval. And that might come to pass, but I don't think that's going to be so in the very immediate future.
Well, with that projection, it's probably about time to end this conversation.
All right. Thank you very much. Well, thanks very much. I enjoyed it, Jim.